This is Northumberland at 5.
Hi, and welcome to Northumberland at 5. I'm your host, Dan Jones. I have a great show for you today, an awesome discussion with Joelle Paig of the Community Health Centers of Northumberland and the great work they are doing to increase food security in rural Northumberland. Later on in the show, we'll have an interview with Alderville First Nation Chief Tainar Simpson and consider this host, Robert Washburn. And of course, local music coming your way, so stick around.
If you've got leaving on your mind,
back, relax.
with some amazing local music. Great to have you on the show today. Increasing access to affordable, nutritious foods in Colborne is becoming more of a reality for residents with the addition of two community mobile food markets. While the Community Health Centers of Northumberland operates twice monthly markets in Grafton and in Colborne, budget-minded community members can purchase produce and locally raised meats and prepared foods at a discount. Joelle Pegg, the food market coordinator, says while the turnout has been incredible in Colborne, more advertising may create a busier market.
We started with the Grafton market first, and the Colborne one has just been since May, I believe, we started. And there's been an awesome turnout. There's regulars that come out there. I'd still like it to be busier, so we're working on advertising it more on our social media and reminding people. I think because we're only there every other week, every 2 weeks, it's kind of easy to forget about and not have it in your schedule. But we do have probably at least a dozen people that come regularly and expect us to be there now. And there was more people, some new people, the last couple times that we were there. I really like the location, the Mystic yoga studio there. It's a cute little spot, and they've been very gracious in hosting us, so we're happy to have the spot, and we'll continue to try and reach people out there, because I know it's a bit of a food desert, and we've had some people concerned with accessing food at an affordable price at the Colborne location.
Now, with the Colborne location, and I guess you could speak to Grafton, what have you learned that you've seen our successes, and maybe what you've learned you can see as improvements?
The Colborne location, it's a really nice spot right on the main strip, so it's easily walkable for people that live in the area. And just having anything there is a success, because right now they have the Rutherford Market reopened, and that is much better than having no grocery store available, but it's not as walkable, and the prices understandably are higher because it's a farmer's market and it's local food, so those tend to be costlier items, and not everybody can afford that right now, so we're just trying to have an alternative for people.
Now, you're talking about the availability and the timing. Has there been a request or demand to go from every other week to every week?
No demands, no. But yes, there has been some requests. Unfortunately, with programs like this, we're kind of tied to our work hours and when people are available to go. I'd love to have more markets available in the evening for people or on the weekends, but we don't operate in those hours. So I know the hours are a bit of a barrier for some people that work, especially if they work multiple jobs, that they're not going to be available in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday. So a lot of our customers are seniors. Most of our customers are seniors. And that is a population that we did want to specifically address. So we're happy to be addressing that. The market's great for being able to buy just small portions of things for people that are living on their own. They can just buy one carrot or a quarter of a cabbage, so they're not wasting money on food that they're going to end up throwing out. So it can be a big savings for that. But I would also like to address barriers for people, working families that have trouble getting there at that time and are buying larger amounts of food.
One possible idea would be that to create a food box. If someone phoned in, would you be able to do like a phone-in order like they do at regular grocery stores now?
Yeah, we did, not through the market, but our food bank did do that during the pandemic, just because we couldn't have people in the building at that time. So we'd prepare boxes for people to pick up and take home. It was very work intensive for us, loading up those boxes, and not everybody, there's some amount of waste in that because we weren't able to take individual orders from people, and then they'd end up getting things in their box that they weren't necessarily going to use. So I hate to waste food. It's nice with an in-person shopping model that people can just pick up what they want and not have to be forced to take things that they don't want and feel like they're wasting it. We don't want to waste it. They don't want to waste it. So in short, yes, it is a possibility, but probably not in the near future.
Okay. Now, I noticed that when the program launched in Grafton in the winter, and I was talking to Adam Hudson about this, it was limited to, you know, root vegetables because there wasn't in season. But now you're in season. So we're seeing more green beans and seasonal fruits and vegetables. How has been the reaction of the patrons to the access of new and seasonal produce?
Yes, everybody is quite happy. I think people were waiting because we run all year round, and people were waiting for the extra colorful, fresh things to arrive into the market. So people are very happy to be getting their corn, their beans, all the fresh greens, the fruits that you don't get in the winter. And we're only serving things that are grown in Ontario all year round, and in the summer I try to focus just on Northumberland stuff. I did have some Niagara peaches because they're a crowd pleaser. But other than that, it's all Northumberland grown. And we had raspberries this week too. People were very excited about the raspberries. those items are expensive to buy, especially locally, because they perish quickly and they're labor intensive to pick, and they're so delicate. So we do reduce those items even more than the regular items to make it even more affordable to buy things that are locally grown, because we know people love them. So we want to make them as accessible as possible and get in as many fresh fruits and vegetables and all the colors of the rainbow now before winter hits again and we're back to potatoes and squash. And I love those things anyway, and we make a lot of soups. So in the winter, we focus more on our soups and our meals and our meat, the local meats here. So we still keep people fed and happy, but it's a different palate for the summertime. I think people look forward to it in the same way that they look forward to the changing seasons. It's just a different feel.
Right on. And I know that when this program was being launched, one of the key components was a relationship with farmers to help supply the produce. Talk to me, just can you highlight how that's strengthened, and are you seeing more farmers coming on online? And what are the farmers really telling you about how this program is going?
Yes, we have 10 farmers, I believe, right now that we're working with. And it varies by season, too, because a lot of people aren't sowing anything over the winter. They close right down. But over the summer right now, we've added a few new farmers to our list that we're happy to be working with. And some of them are organic farmers. Some of them are charitable organizations themselves. Like Living Ways Foundation, we started working with, and they grow food for to help people learn how to grow food and for environmental reasons, and to help people access food that are having trouble to access food. So we're happy to buy their produce. The Cold Springs Organics we partnered with this year as well, and they grow lovely, beautiful produce that is organic. One of my neighbors is selling me corn from Maple Vista Farms there. So it's literally, I leave my house and I drive 30 seconds and go pick up corn down the road. Then I have another neighbor, Racine Farm, just on the other side of the block that I can pick up squash and sweet potatoes with. So it's created a community of like-minded people that are all trying to provide food for their neighbors, and we're happy to promote their food and to support them so that they're able to continue to provide food for the people of Northumberland.
Coming up later this hour, a discussion between Alderville First Nation Chief Tainar Simpson and Consider This host, Robert Washburn.
Northumberland 89.7 is radio to go. Along with broadcasters from across the country, we are part of a collaboration with Radio Player Canada, providing one stop for content and information that interests you anywhere you happen to be. Just download the Radio Player Canada app for free in the Google or iTunes App Store. Search out Northumberland 89.7 and you can listen to truly local radio anywhere.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jacob of SMM Law Professional Corporation. Does someone owe you money for damaging something or for purchasing something they haven't paid for? A small claims court claim may be part of the answer. Call SMM Law at 905-372-3395 or email hello@smmlaw.com. SMM Law, we are here for you.
Did you know that we spend a third of our lives in bed?
Kerry here from Sleep Made Simple Mattress Center. Yes, we spend more time in our beds than ever. We read, eat, work, play, sleep, and repeat for years. At Sleep Made Simple, you'll find a complete selection of Canadian-made mattresses by Serta Simmons and Sleep King. So drop in, lie down, and talk to one of our friendly, experienced sales staff to help you find your best bed and a great night's sleep. We do more in bed than ever before. Make sure it's the right bed.
Visit Sleep Made Simple, 1 King Street East, downtown Cobourg.
We've been putting Northumberland to bed for over 40 years.
Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm so pleased to be back with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. Good to see you again, Chief.
Great to see you, Robert.
I'd like to start by talking about the wildfires taking place across the country. Some people may not recognize that the number of Indigenous people and communities who have been adversely affected. How would you describe the situation for the First Nations facing wildfires in Ontario this season?
Well, I think this year has been worse than any year that I can recall, especially since I've been paying attention. We've had a couple of First Nations in Ontario that were completely destroyed by wildfire. And it's something that, you know, we're probably going to see more of with the changing weather. So we really want to ensure that when something like this happens in the future, we're ready and all systems are go.
At this time of the recording, about 2,000 evacuees from across northeastern Ontario have returned home since the wildfires began in mid-July. Still, just over 800 people remain displaced. Now, you mentioned this, and I think it's important to name them. Two First Nations communities were completely destroyed, as you said, and that's the Collins First Nation and the Whitewater First Nation. When you hear this news, what is your reaction?
Well, I think when the fires first hit, we were having our Assembly First Nations assembly in Ottawa, and the chief was there, and she had to leave to attend to the wildfire. So this was happening in real time when all the chiefs were together, and we were coordinating efforts to help when at the time there didn't seem to be any help from any of the other bodies or entities, if you will, in the province or in the nation. We were just so shocked by how little resources and information was there, to the point where they didn't even know there was a fire. MNR didn't even know that there was a fire that was about to destroy the community.
I'd like to come back to that in a moment, but I'd also like to ask you, though, there are some First Nation leaders, particularly in Gull Bay, who believe the members of their community to still be at risk, despite the Ontario government's withdrawal of area restrictions and evacuations orders. What does this say to you?
Well, Chief King has been quite adamant in his response that none of the preparations have been adequate. So Chief King's particular concern is that there's pretty much only one road out of town. And if a fire were to overtake that road, it would block off their only exit. Their only other option being to jump into the lake and try to get to the other side. So this is something that we've been seeing more and more, that whatever cutbacks have happened in the past, it has led to a position where there's no proper systems in place for notifying the communities. There's no way for proper evacuation orders to go out in time. And in fact, they just don't know the lay of the land. So not understanding that there might only be one way out of the community and thinking that the fire is safe from them doesn't necessarily mean that if a fire does hit, that they would be able to evacuate safely.
You are part of the Chiefs of Ontario, and I know that they've been quite outspoken in the last number of weeks. How would you characterize the response by the government during this period in terms of evacuations? And what would you attribute the delays in response?
I think it's just a lack of preparedness on the both the federal and the provincial government side. I don't think that they were expecting fires of this magnitude, and they just didn't have their legwork done to be able to respond for something like this that was going to happen. And then there's other reasons that there's cause for concern. So the chief of the first community that was burned down, Collins First Nation, they didn't receive a call from the government, any government entity, until 2 days after their community had burned to the ground. So this wasn't a real-time activity. This was something like, oh, we're sorry, your community's gone. So that just shows the appalling lack of preparation, foresight, and breaking down of the system that happened for this community.
So what then is the role for the Chiefs of Ontario to play in a situation like this?
Well, I think the First Nations need to come up with their own evacuation plan, have their own fire systems, and also fire management. If there was more ability to fight these fires in real time as they're happening, I think that there would be less fires. The smaller fires would be able to be extinguished before they become big fires. So I think it's an overall overhaul of the whole system that needs to happen. So have on-the-ground ability to stop these fires or fight these fires, to buy them a bit more time. Also have more information sharing and understanding where these fires are and putting people on alert a little bit before the fires hit. So there was just that breakdown across the board that led to these disasters. And thankfully, no one was seriously hurt.
Could you explain a little more deeply the idea of First Nations having the ability to fight these fires and be first responders? What do you see that taking? What resources would be necessary?
Well, I think you would need to have actual infrastructure in place. You would need equipment in place, firefighting equipment. You would need training on the ground for forest fire volunteers, forest fire specialists. I know in Alderville, we had the ability to train a number of our members in fire, forest fire management, forest fire fighting. So this is something that is out there. So it's a matter of getting the training where it's needed, getting the equipment where it's needed, and putting up areas that you're able to detect when fires are happening in real time. So instead of looking over the hill and seeing the fire coming, knowing well ahead of time that fire is actually approaching you.
But with the size and the scope of these fires, are Indigenous communities, do they have enough people? It's one thing to have the equipment and the skill, but they're so large. How would that work?
Well, I think once a fire has been identified through an improved system to identify fires when they happen, I think at that point, either if it's not a big fire, they should be able to tackle it with the aid of other firefighting resources in the area, or at least buy the community enough time to make a safe escape. Sometimes just buying those extra minutes and hours would make the difference between life and death.
What are the impacts on evacuees when they must be moved from their home communities to other locations?
Well, this is unfortunate. So a lot of the evacuees originally were relocated to Niagara Falls. And in Niagara Falls, they were put up in hotels, but there was an onslaught of racism against them, saying that they got a free vacation, saying that, they didn't deserve this. So there was a lot of racism directed towards the evacuees. And we've seen this in previous years. We experienced it last year with evacuees in Peterborough. So it's I don't know what the answer is, but we do know that the evacuees aren't treated very well by the host communities that are taking them in. So if there's a way we could work on some sort of, you know, anti-racism campaign at the same time as these evacuees, but I don't know what the answer is there. A lot of the communities, I know in Alderville, we offered to open up our old shelter for evacuees, but there was a lot of logistics and breaking up of families. So we really need to have large capacity cities or towns to take in the number of evacuees that these forest fires create.
Are there Indigenous organizations who assist and monitor these people as they wait to return home? And what services would be available to them?
There are. So I know through, I think it's Indian Affairs, ISC, they are able to have someone on the ground. So there's like a liaison who is organizing the evacuation, and they will check in every once in a while. But they're not necessarily always on the ground. They're more of an overseer of the overall project. And then it gets down to there's a lot of volunteers and some paid staff, perhaps from the towns or the municipalities. But I know when it happens in our area, we get together with Hiawatha. We send over as many volunteers as we can to help gather blankets and food, and just to go around and talk to the evacuees to see if they have any specific needs, because you want to make sure you're giving them the need that they want. I remember last year we got a lot of baby stuff. We had diapers and baby food and everything, but it turns out there's only a few babies, so they were inundated with baby supplies when they actually needed other types of supplies. So understanding what the evacuees need in the moment is critical.
There have been requests to restore First Nations autonomy to managing forests. Can you tell us about this?
Well, this is definitely something that is on everybody's radar. Because we know that the current system isn't working. We know with all of the spraying for herbicides that has made the problem a lot larger than it should have been. So it creates a lot of deadfall that becomes just a tinderbox when fires do happen. So I think having the traditional knowledge of our forest keeping helping out to create more forest fireproof forests. Because if you have a healthy underground and a healthy underbrush, if you have healthy trees, then it's not quite as big of a tinderbox. The fires won't spread as quickly, they won't be as severe, and there'll be a lot more surviving trees after the forest fire passes.
There is something that is historically significant in the way that First Nations manage forests, and that is something we call today a controlled burn. Can you share with us what a controlled burn is and how it's culturally significant?
Yes, this is something Alderville is at the leading edge of with controlled burns with our Black Oak Savannah. We have an annual controlled burn, which we have on the Black Oak Savannah to replenish the tall grass seeds. It also makes it more fire resistant in the future. So when you have a controlled burn, you're getting rid of any of the dead underbrush that becomes that tinderbox material for those fires. You are adding nutrients into the soil so that the new fresh underbrush growth can come through. You're allowing the moisture to get more to the plants that need them. So you create a more resistant forest by having these controlled burns. So the trees themselves are capable of withstanding forest fires. They've been happening for millions of years, and the trees have built up this natural resistance. But the problem is, once a forest fire gets to a specific heat and size, because of this unburned underbrush that's dead, they take out the trees. So the trees that can normally survive a regular fire can't survive these great infernos that are caused by the mismanagement of the forests that we're seeing today.
The Assembly of First Nations held an event in July of 2025 regarding a First Nations fire protection strategy to review and discuss a national framework to enhance prevention and emergency preparedness across the country. Do you know what the status is of that strategy currently?
I do not. It's not something that that I've been briefed on fully. I do think it's one of the reasons why we have been talking with the federal government more about wildfire management, why some resources have been given towards training of our members in wildfire forest prevention and fighting. So I think we're seeing the trickle-down effect of it, but I'd have to say, you know, what I can see, it seems to be there's some positives coming out, but then when you look at what happened this summer, you can see that it's got a long way to go before it's going to be able to reach its goal.
How does a community rebuild when they return? I mean, the infrastructure is all gone and these places are so remote. So what are some of the unique challenges these communities will face that might not be the same as other communities when they return?
Yes, so this is something I've been thinking a lot about. So when you look at Namegusagoosagin, also Collins First Nation, that's its English name, I can't imagine what they're going through. They're not actually a federally recognized reserve. They are all First Nation members, but Indian Affairs has not acknowledged them as an actual First Nation. So the funds aren't there to help them that they would be normally for a First Nation. So I can't even begin to think of what the next steps are for them. They have to rebuild completely all of their community infrastructure, all of their health services, all their homes. Like they're going back to nothing. So they have to rebuild completely from scratch. And I try to think of what happened if that happened in Alderville. Like we would just be throwing our hands up and say, oh my gosh, this is the end. Like there really is, it's a monumental task. We've been working with some allies to raise funds for them, but even whatever we can raise, it's just going to be a drop in the bucket for what's actually required to rebuild a community from scratch.
Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tanar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back.
Northumberland 89.7 second annual Loud and Local Yard Sale, Saturday, August 22nd from 8 a.m. until 2 p.m. in our very own parking lot at 1000 Elgin Street West, Coburg. You'll find a variety of artwork, furniture, kitchen items, kids' toys, and maybe something you weren't even looking for, all while supporting your local community radio station, Northumberland 89.7. We'll see you August 22nd.
The Road to Cultivate returns Thursday, August 20th at Memorial Park in downtown Port Hope. This week, in collaboration with Port Hope Jazz, the Angela Pinchente Big Band delivers an unforgettable evening of modern jazz featuring bold arrangements, incredible musicianship, and an energy of a world-class big band. Bring a lawn chair, gather some friends, and enjoy a summer evening of great music, community, and connection. Music starts at 6 p.m. It's free, it's all ages, and it's right here in Port Hope. The Road to Cultivate, every Thursday, all summer long. Learn more at cultivatefestival.ca.
Need to report a non-emergency crime or suspicious activity? The Coburg Police Service makes it easy. File a report online at coburgpoliceservice.com or call 905-372-6821. Want to stay anonymous? Contact Crime Stoppers. Reports are not accepted through social media or email. If it happens now or if it's an emergency, call 911. Your reports help solve crime and keep our community safe. A message from the Coburg Police Service.
And now, Northumberland Humane Society Pet of the Week, brought to you by Northumberland 89.7 FM. Meet Pup, a lovable 4-year-old American Bulldog. He's playful, affectionate, enjoys calm dogs, and loves adventures with his people. Pup does have allergies that need ongoing care, but he has plenty of love to give. Visit northumberland897.ca or call 905-885-4131 to learn more about Pup today, because every pet deserves a loving home.
Now proudly sponsored by Santos Auto Group, your local Hyundai, Volkswagen, and Chrysler dealerships.
Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tanar Simpson, the chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. There is a call for a public inquiry into Ontario's wildfire response. Is this really necessary?
I think it's the only way to find out what went wrong and how to prevent such a disaster in the future. So they were victimized, obviously, by the wildfire in the first place, but then the response from both the federal and provincial governments were appalling. They truly were. The fact that they were told there was no fire when the fire was raging down on them. And then they didn't get a call till 2 days after their community was destroyed. There was no warning. So they were basically left to defend on their own, to escape on their own. So the fact that there was nothing for them necessitates an inquiry, because there has to be some answers of why there was zero help for them in their greatest time of need.
But don't you think the various departments and agencies realize that they've not responded appropriately and have learned their lessons?
Well, maybe on an individual agency level, they can. But you have all these different agencies working in their own little bubble. But there's no overall overarching plan to see how all these systemic failures work together. So once you're looking at your own little piece, you can't see the bigger picture. So you need these inquiries to understand how the overall system failed and how each piece can do its best to ensure that this doesn't happen again. So I don't think there is one agency that could come up with the solution. You need all the eyes on everything from that top-down look to be able to truly see the extent of the failure.
How can First Nations, though, ensure a public inquiry doesn't whitewash the process and systemic changes don't occur?
Well, I think inquiries like this in the past, they've been pretty good at identifying the problem. They've been pretty good at recommending the plans that you should put in place moving forward. Where we always fail is the actual implementation of the recommendations that come out of inquiries like this. So I feel the inquiry would be successful if it's given the ability to go through its whole mandate. But then it's up to the political will of the political actors to actually implement those changes that are needed.
So what are the next steps then from a First Nations perspective?
Well, I think the First Nations are going to be a lot more aware next year. I think being alert to all fires, maybe going back to the old days where you put up the that ranger tower, that fire tower, where, you know, my dad worked in one of these when he was a kid. And then one day, like, you know, they had satellites and planes and they said, we don't need these fire watchtowers anymore. So I think maybe you almost need to go back to that, because those eyes on the ground are going to be the first ones to spot this fire, because we know that those systems failed. So I think all the First Nations, especially in Northern Ontario that are surrounded by these forests, are going to have to be much more alert on their own. They definitely can't rely on the government to keep them informed about anything. So I think everyone's going to start doing their part on fire prevention more. I think, you know, reporting fires during a fire ban is important. We've had fire bans this year, and we take those very seriously. Like, you, when there's a fire ban, just don't have a fire, because it all it takes is one fire, and then you have a massive outbreak again. So I think, you know, First Nations are going to be a lot more cautious next year, and we're going to be on alert. We are in Alderville, because we are surrounded by a lot of forests in Alderville. So I think it's everyone needs to do their part everywhere.
I'd like to now bring our subject matter a little closer to home. What is the status of the Alderville trespass law?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Robert. So we are currently in the process of repealing our old trespass law and implementing a new trespass law with the help of Falls Law. So we have been engaging the community earlier this month. Falls Law met with our elders at the All the Day program, and we also hosted a community meeting that same evening. I believe it was August 5th. Where we laid out the plans for our new trespass law. And this new law is going to be enforceable under current OPP regulations.
Tell us a bit more about this. Just a bit of history, please, because I understand that there was a bylaw passed in 2020. How is this one different from that one?
Well, the old trespass law was written in a language that wasn't compatible with OPP enforcement. I think much of this old law was doing its best to address the problem, but the wording wasn't in a way that we were able to actually have it enforced by the OPP. The language needs to match the criminal code. It needs to match what the OPP understand to be trespass. We need to have citations and tickets, basically, also that look like the mainstream OPP tickets. So basically, it's the law is going to try to be the same. It's hitting the same prohibited activities. So the purpose of it is to protect health, safety, and well-being of the Alderville First Nation community members, lands, and waters by controlling who is permitted to enter and remain on Alderville First Nation lands.
Can you help us understand a bit more about the problems that were existing that were trying to be addressed?
Okay, so last summer we had some instances in the community where there were people from up north and out of town that were had basically taken up shop in Alderville, and they were causing all kinds of problems. And we just, first of all, we weren't able to identify and capture them because they kept on the move. But even if we had, we didn't have a system, a trespass law in place that we could have actually had them removed. Fortunately, they were able to leave on their own after after commandeering a vehicle. So that solved that problem in the short term. But then we realized we're really at the mercy of anybody that wants to cause harm to Alderville. So that's when we decided that we're going to go in and create a law, repeal the old law, and create a law that is truly enforceable by the OPP. This has been, we've worked on this in unison with the OPP to understand what their requirements are. So this new law is coming under through Falls Law, which they were working with Mississauga 8 up north, and they got the first person trespassed and I guess convicted under Indigenous law in the province. So we're like, that kind of piqued our interest. So we went and hired that law firm to help us try to get the same results here in Alderville.
You and I have had a conversation before about a possible police force in Alderville. What is the status of those discussions?
Well, they've been moving at a snail's pace, but there has been progress. We've been hearing that Aboriginal policing services might be opening up again. This is something that we're optimistic for. We would definitely like to see more policing presence in Alderville. The OPP have been pretty good with keeping us informed and coming when these issues arise. So we feel that the OPP response has been improving over the years, but we do feel like we do need some form of Indigenous First Nations policing here in Alderville.
So what are next steps then in this process?
Well, we have another open community council where coming up later in the month, where we're going to engage with the community. Ultimately, under the Charter Gaywin, our law can be ratified by an open council by resolution of chief and council. So this is something that we are going to be involving the community. The last meeting, although it wasn't well attended, the questions asked were very good. So we feel like we are getting some good community input. We also have been hearing from our members that a lot of our elders don't feel safe. They do want some extra protection. And our job as elected leaders is to ensure the safety of our community and do everything in our power to keep our community safe.
Now it's time for our public service announcements. What have you got for us?
Okay, today I've got some general announcements, but on August 20th, we have a community baseball night at the Glen Crow Sports Field. It's 6 to 8 p.m., so I'm asking all community members to bring their families and enjoy a night out for baseball, seeing as we're getting ready for playoff season. Hopefully the Jays make it. We're all feeling the baseball fever right now. I also want to talk about August 26th special council meeting with Falls Law to discuss our new trespass law, and that's going to be 7 to 8 p.m. So come here, Jay Herbert and Cassandra Balls, Bars, talk about the new trespass law. In terms of general announcements, I just want to remind not just Alderville members, but all members in Northumberland and beyond, all citizens, that there's a class action and settlement agreement for 13 provincially operated training schools for youth. So anyone who attended these, the claim period is now open, and the deadline to get on the class action is September 27th, 2027. So we know in Coburg there was Brookside. So anybody who attended this institution is potentially available to join that class action. So I also want to put the call out to Alderville members that we are forming a planning committee to honor the 100th anniversary of the Alderville Cenotaph in 2027. So Councillor Jason Marsden is heading up this wonderful event, and we're all very proud of our Alderville Cenotaph, which is the main attraction in Alderville. It's the tallest building, our structure, so we want to give it the proper 100th anniversary. And also, I just want to remind people, as children are going back to school in a couple of weeks, to take extra care and caution on the roads as the children return in the fall. So be mindful of school buses, especially when they've stopped and the children are getting off or on the bus. We know every year we see incidences and close calls, so I just want to let everyone know, please take extra care around those school buses. And that's my announcements.
Chief, I appreciate your time. I want to thank you for this conversation today.
Thank you. Always happy to be here.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.
Come on, feet. Start moving. Got to get me there.
If you want to relive old-time rock and roll at its best, then the Phantom Jukebox is the place to be. Each week, you'll hear J.P. Phantom playing the hits, the flips, and the songs you should have heard. All that and some of the stories behind the songs. That's the Phantom Jukebox every Saturday night at 6 p.m. and again Wednesday at 3, only on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio.
Summer's too short to spend it worrying about computer problems. While you're enjoying the cottage, the golf course, or just a well-earned day off, Attitude IT is helping keep local businesses running smoothly and protected from cyber threats. Your local IT team providing friendly, supportive, protective security and peace of mind, all backed by your cyber assurance. This summer, spend less time stressing about your technology and more time enjoying the sunshine. Attitude IT, keeping your technology on course. Visit attitudeit.ca or call today at 905-432-7751 and talk to our team today.
Husbands, want to make your wife stay? Take her to Village Beauty Bar in Port Hope. Treat her to a personalized Eminence or Dermalogica facial and let her relax, unwind, and leave absolutely glowing, because a relaxed wife makes a happy life. Village Beauty Bar at 18 Ontario Street in Port Hope. Call or text 905-373-8260. Village Beauty Bar, where beauty meets wellness.
Here's what's happening in Northumberland.
Hi, this is Andrea with What's Happening. The Northumberland Humane Society have an online auction, and that will be running until August the 23rd at 5 p.m. To bid, register at NHS4, that's the number 4, paws.actria.events. NHS4paws.AUCTRIA.EVENTS. And it's all in support of the animals, so please bid, bid, bid. They're also having a bottle drive, and you can drop your bottles off at the Northumberland Humane Society's thrift store, 24 Covert Street, at the back door, and that's in Coburg. Friends of the Wesleyville Village present their pop-up music with Gallo and Kaz, and it's folk music, Tuesday, August 18th, 6:30 p.m. Concerts in Brighton's Memorial Park are Wednesday, August 19th at 6:30 with The Reasons. Road to Cultivate presents collaboration with the Port Hope Jazz, featuring Angela Pinsent Big Band in the Port Hope Memorial Band Shell, Thursday, August 20th. The music starts at 6 and the Maker's Market is open at 3. The Port Hope Jazz Festival celebrates their 25th anniversary, starting Thursday, August 20th with a concert in the Band Shell and continuing through till Sunday, August 23rd with a huge lineup of professional entertainment throughout the various venues in downtown Port Hope. For a full lineup, go to porthopejazz.com.
If you have an upcoming event you'd like us to share, email info@northumberland897.ca.
At Northumberland 89.7, we bring you a wide variety of programs. If you miss a show, remember, you can always catch our special interviews and programs on your time. Just go to the podcast section of our website and select the show you want to listen to. It's all at northumberland897.ca.
Well, that's going to do it for me today. Coming up, the 6 o'clock news. Have a great evening. Take care of yourself and each other.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody.